Do you have just a minute?
Call the House Committee on Judiciary to order. Today is May 2nd, 2017. We have to be on the floor today at 2 o'clock, so we probably won't get through the whole agenda. We'll open an informational meeting on House Bill 3321.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. House Bill 3321 would require certain nonprofit corporations to comply with open meetings and public records law.
Thought I'd have more time.
Representative Evans, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I was very brief. I thought I'd have more time to get up here and put my papers out. For the record, I'm Paul Evans, representing House District 20, Monmouth Independence, West Salem, South Salem. And I'm here today to talk briefly about House Bill 3321, and I want you to know that I appreciate you taking time in your schedule to hear this bill. It is told, it is said, it is now modern myth that either former Supreme Court Justice Brandeis or Douglas, you can find both listed with this quote, tells us that sunlight is the best disinfectant. And whoever actually came up with that, I happen to think it is, in fact, a truth. I think that when you're doing public business, transparency is always something that promotes the public good. It may not be fun, but it's always good. This measure is, I hope, a beginning of a conversation. And I want to set the table real quick for why I've put this bill forward. I believe the 21st century economy is driving a proliferation in nonprofit organizations, government across the nation, and quite frankly, beyond our borders as well, is being asked to do more absent the resources or the capacity to do it, often on subjects that promise far more risk than reward, meaning that governments sometimes don't have the resources to do what we used to do. They certainly may not have the resources to do what we'd like to do. So we try to find the best alternative. Often that means contracting out public services, public functions, through the nonprofit vehicle. We have about 22,000, at least my most recent report here, about 22,000 tax-exempt organizations in the state of Oregon, and some 166,130 jobs, roughly 13% of the Oregon economy is in nonprofits, and that I suspect is actually dated. This is about 3 years old. I say that because sometimes we forget when we're talking about nonprofits that nonprofits are in fact a public subsidy. That even those nonprofits that every year raise the funds from folks may not have particularly a public function, but they're doing something they believe is important for their community, and it likely is, that there's still a subsidy involved when charitable donations are actually given the ability to be written off. We have a public stake in the activities of most of these organizations. I believe that as we look toward the 21st century and as we try to figure out how we're going to build living wages and the social safety nets out of an economy that's not like we are familiar with in terms of manufacturing, et cetera, we're probably going to rely on more nonprofits. And if that's the case, there are some things that I believe we don't know about nonprofits that we probably should have greater transparency on. It is true, nonprofits have to put in annual reports, but nonprofits do not currently have to abide by public meeting laws. Nonprofits do not, at this point, have to share all of the finances in a timely manner, or at least in an easily understandable manner. Nonprofits often exist to provide sustainable services in a fair, honorable, and transparent manner, but there are a few nonprofits, that have used the nonprofit status as a cloaking device, hiding activities that may be viewed by those engaged as serving the public, but in fact have consequence. There are in fact certain nonprofits that have a predatory practice in terms of gobbling up for-profit enterprises and then using the facilities, because they're now nonprofit, they're now non-taxable, and benefiting from that. My concern is as we look forward and we look toward the future, that we do not set up a situation that Orwell would recognize from the farm, where some animals are more equal than other animals. I'm bothered by the fact that there are some nonprofits in the state that do many of the same services that state employees may do, but at a lower wage, with less protection, and in conditions that are not, shall we say, safe or secure. Now, again, I do not believe that this is the vast majority. In fact, I believe it's probably just the opposite. But I do believe that some nonprofits have forgotten that the whole value of being a nonprofit is that you put the funds that you potentially could be seen as above the cost that could be called profitable back into services. We have a situation in this community where one nonprofit has a chief executive officer that earns $1.4 million a year. I'm certain that that person's very good at what they do, but $1.4 million a year is a lot in a nonprofit. It bothers me when we have less transparency. It bothers me that the state of Oregon may be unaware of some of the practices that are going on. So today, thank you very much for the opportunity to consider this bill. There are some speakers that are going to come up and tell you firsthand their experiences. God bless. I know this bill is not moving this year, but my goal is to have a meaningful conversation moving forward, trying to ensure that if, in fact, some of these enterprises are nothing but public enterprises done a different way, that the public at least ensures that there is greater transparency. Any questions you might have?
Representative Evans. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Next is called Tyler Woodward. Ms. Layton and Evan Dumas. Okay. You go in any order, just please remember to identify yourself on the record.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tyler Woodard. I'm a researcher with AFSCME Council 75 here in Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here today to urge all of you to support House Bill 3321. In the last 10 years, there have been numerous examples of nonprofit agencies in Oregon undergoing financial difficulties and jeopardizing services that thousands of Oregonians rely on. These examples are some of the most high profile. In 2008, Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare was required to pay back $2.7 million it had overbilled Medicaid for and was almost forced into bankruptcy. At the time, 70% of Medicaid patients with behavioral health diagnoses in the Portland metro area were receiving treatment through Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare. To prevent the closure of the nonprofit and to preserve the behavioral health Medicaid system in Multnomah County and the Portland metro area, both Multnomah County and the state of Oregon were forced to step in and offer the agency a $2.5 million loan. In addition to the loan, Multnomah County also developed a plan to move some of Cascadia's programs to other agencies, and the nonprofit ultimately shrank by 30%. In 2012, the state of Oregon canceled a $500,000 contract with the Salem nonprofit Oregon Rise, which assisted families with children with disabilities amid allegations of theft. Oregon Rise's director, Janice Roberts, was later convicted of 14 counts of theft and required to pay $78,000 in restitution. In 2015, the Portland foster care provider, Give Us This Day, was forced to close as part of a settlement with the Justice Department. A former staff member had accused the nonprofit of mistreating children at the group home and claimed the nonprofit had failed to provide children with groceries, grooming products, clean sheets, or even mattresses. State officials later accused the owner, Mary Ayala, of misspending at least $2 million in state funds. This amount included $100,000 to buy property, $213,000 to remodel and furnish her home, $249,800 for trips, meals, clothes, and beauty expenses, including cosmetic surgery. This is according to an Oregonian article about the investigation. In 2016, Multnomah County placed the nonprofit Impact Northwest, an agency that is contracted to run the school's Uniting Neighborhood program in 9 Portland area schools, on a financial improvement plan due to the agency facing budget difficulties. In the years 2015 and 2016, Impact Northwest reported losses of $817,000 and $1.2 million. A recent Willamette Week article reported that the agency was still facing financial challenges as of April 2017. And again, these are just some of the most high-profile cases. Just last week, for example, in Eugene, a drug and alcohol nonprofit, it was reported that an employee was arrested and there are allegations that $250,000 has gone missing. So these are just the ones that really stand out. This bill would do the following to increase transparency in the providing of public services and ensure that our tax dollars are being used both effectively and appropriately. The first is requiring board of directors meetings to comply with the public meetings laws. The second is requiring nonprofits to publicly post their budgets for up to 30 days prior to being adopted by their boards. The third is requiring nonprofits to submit to audits by the Secretary of State's office or the public entity that gave the nonprofit the funds. And the fourth is requiring collections of nonprofit records to ensure that when bad actors are found, what allowed them to get away with what they were doing does not happen in the future. For the first off, I think that requiring board of directors meetings to comply with public meetings laws is a necessary reform, because currently, if a citizen of Oregon has a problem while accessing a public service, either through a city, county, or the state, it's fairly easy who they can take up that issue with, right? They can call a city councilor, they can call their local representative, they can call a county commissioner. If a client of the Multnomah County Health Department, for example, feels that there are issues in the way that Multnomah County is providing public health services, they can attend a county commission meeting and raise their concern. It is hard for clients and nonprofit agencies to do something similar. Many nonprofits do not publicly list the dates and times of their board meetings or where they are, nor do they list ways to contact members of their board of directors. Many decisions made at board meetings ultimately affect not only the clients or employees in the nonprofit agency, but our entire community. For example, the community behavioral health system in Portland has seen a dramatic increase in resources in the last 5 years. The six largest agencies providing behavioral health services in the Portland metro area have seen an average increase of 40% over that time period. And last, in their latest publicly reported tax filings, they reported an annual profit of $4.6 million on average. However, despite this increase in resources and these high profits, a 2016 survey of behavioral health outcomes by Mental Health America ranked Oregon 51st in the entire nation, behind every other state and the District of Columbia. While Oregon was finishing dead last in behavioral health outcomes, nonprofit CEOs at these same agencies also have seen an average increase in financial compensation of 33.6% over that time period. Requiring decisions about resource allocations that our community provides or relies on to be made publicly will increase transparency and accountability, ensuring a more efficient usage of public resources. Requiring nonprofits to publicly post their budgets for up to 30 days goes into this as well. In addition to holding public meetings on the budget, publicly supported nonprofits should be required to publicly post how they are allocating their resources. Public agencies such as cities, counties, special districts, and the state already are required to do this. Again, I use the community behavioral health example. While Oregon, again, was ranked 51st in outcomes, and these six largest agencies were reporting average profits of $4.6 million, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, employees employed in the Portland metro area as community or as mental health counselors or addictions and or behavioral health and addictions counselors, their wages failed to keep pace with inflation. They increased by 6% and 8% respectively, while top administrators at nonprofit agencies were seeing increases of over 33% in the same time period. If we required these decisions to be made publicly, it would hold nonprofits accountable for the way that they are allocating resources and ensure that these resources are going to providing services the community relies on. Requiring nonprofits to submit to audits by the Secretary of State's office or the entity that gave them the funds is actually not that big a change. Currently, nonprofits that receive over $750,000 in a year from the federal government are required to perform yearly audits themselves. It makes sense to ask agencies that are relying on public dollars to open their books and be accountable to the government bodies who are providing them these resources. Requiring nonprofits to be subject to audits will increase transparency and prevent abuse of public funds. And again, for the final point that this bill would do, too often after a bad actor is brought to light, there's a deficit of information to track down what happened and how this was allowed to occur. If we require nonprofits to retain their records, this will ensure that public agencies can put in place meaningful standards to prevent future abuses of scarce resources. I believe that by increasing transparency and accountability, we can ensure that public services are delivered effectively and public dollars are being used appropriately. I would urge all of you to support this bill.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you so much for making the time for this hearing. For the record, my name is Lila Layton. I am a social worker and coming here from the Solidarity Alliance of Social Services. Until recently, I worked as a therapist at a Portland area community mental health nonprofit. I provided individual and group therapy as well as case management services to adolescents with serious and persistent mental illness. all of my clients were funded by the Oregon Health Plan and came from low opportunity environments at best. Many experienced homelessness, addictions, and the profundity of intergenerational trauma. The young people I worked with needed a rock. They needed a consistent, empathetic presence. They needed critical case management services in order to transition to independence. They needed mentorship and modeling to understand that adulthood can look different than it has in the lives of the other adults they have known. The delivery of services in order to meet these needs hinges upon the quality of the therapeutic relationship. The impact of low transparency is far-reaching and undermines the very important work being done at our social service and behavioral health nonprofits. Wage discrepancies, arbitrary performance evaluations, sudden programmatic changes, lack of access to information, and lack of inclusion in the decision-making process cause irreparable damage to worker morale, causing burnout, which inevitably leads to turnover. In my time working in a community mental health nonprofit, I have had the experience of introducing myself to a youth in crisis as their temporary provider, only filling in until management made a new hire. I've had to explain why their former provider suddenly left and why they maybe were only there for 3 months. I had no answers to give them because I was given no answers. It is not unreasonable for these clients to have felt a sense of mistrust and to become reticent to engage in therapeutic work at all. I'm here today because I believe that if we are unwilling to hold our nonprofits accountable, we not only lose the opportunity to actualize our mission statements, but we also risk losing the lives and livelihoods of our community's most vulnerable populations. Healing, recovery, and community service can only happen if we all commit to transparent practices in the organizations responsible for providing the critical services that countless Oregonians so desperately need. Board of director meetings must comply with open meetings laws. Providers, service users, and the community at large should have access to information regarding nonprofit affairs, and decision making should be inclusive. Nonprofits should also submit to audits by the public entity that gave them funding. We need increased accountability and oversight to ensure that we always maintain clear focus on our commitment to the work. By increasing transparency and accountability, we can be sure that public services are delivered effectively and ethically, and public funds are used appropriately. I urge you all to support this very important bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Evan Dumas. I'm a trainer and educator for burnout and compassion fatigue. I work a lot with public sector agencies, nonprofits, and service industry workers. I don't need to tell you that there's a lot of work for someone specializing in burnout right now. I'm here to recommend greater transparency for nonprofit community mental health agencies so as to reduce worker burnout, to be more fiscally efficient, and to ultimately be a greater service to those seeking help. Thank you for hearing my testimony. This is my first time giving testimony, and the one piece of advice I got was to be honest. And I like that. Honesty promotes trust. And change doesn't happen without trust and honesty. I was trained as a counselor, and this is just as true when working with clients. I feel the government values trust and honesty, or else why would I be here? But this is checked through the value of transparency. Transparency is pretty much enforced honesty. It's the checks and balances that help maintain the trust. Without it, how can we be sure that the system isn't broken? So our community mental health systems are broken. Their budgets are massively increasing, but their outcomes are not improving. Like Tyler said, we ranked dead last in 2016. We were third from last in 2015, so there was hope, but it got worse. So therapists and social workers are all burning out. These are my peers, my friends, my mentors, and this has been going on for a very long time. I'm working to cure burnout because I want to live in a world where this doesn't happen. I believe we can make it better, and I won't give up on that belief. The way we can make this situation better is through transparency. These nonprofit agencies espouse the same values of trust and honesty their employees do, but there's no way of knowing if their excuses for low pay, untenable caseloads, and poor staffing are really so out of their control. We need transparency to build this trust back. Burnout happens for reasons, for lots of reasons, but a big one is being lied to. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel?
I'd just say the other piece of advice would be to be brief, and you did good with that one, too.
Yeah. A brief piece of advice about burnout is that it's not all your problem. You're dealing with a system and definition of professionalism that is somewhat outdated and doesn't allow for emotional intelligence in the workplace. So be a real human. Talk about how much it's hard and get all through this together. You're not alone.
Okay, thank you very much, panel. Next we call Dan, looks like Tanel and Ingrid Brightoff, Dolph.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Dan Torres with Oregon AFSCME, representing 26,000 workers across the state of Oregon, including many folks in nonprofits, including some of the folks in behavioral health nonprofits. I'll make it very brief because I think my colleagues did an exceptional job of putting sort of a point on what we're looking at today. We see this conversation as a starting point. Obviously, as many people said, this bill is not moving forward, and I know that people have some issues on some of the mechanisms about where the threshold is, what some of the transparency mechanisms are. And we see this as, like I said, a starting point. So we look forward to working with members of this committee and other legislators as we move forward to thinking about smart, reasonable ways to bring transparency to some nonprofits. I want to make sure it's abundantly clear, and I think everyone knows this, that this is not a goal of demonizing nonprofits. They do a lot of really great work in our community, and many of you work and or work directly with nonprofits in your community. We just see that there's some need for some transparency we think can help some of the systematic outcomes we see, especially in the areas of mental health. So thank you so much for taking the time. I know you guys are very busy and have a lot of stuff going on. Really appreciate your time allotted today. Thank you.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, I'm Ingrid Brightoff. I'm an attorney at Davis Wright Tremaine, and I'm here on behalf of Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I also, in my practice, represent a lot of nonprofits, both inside and outside of healthcare. I will endeavor to be brief. I'm here in opposition to the bill because I think it seeks to find a problem that we already have solutions to. The proponents have mentioned transparency, the need for greater information to be out in the environment, especially associated with public funds. And I would argue that either this bill doesn't address the problems, I think that some of which are real problems that they identified, or the tools already exist for the agencies to get at the problems that have been identified. So first, in terms of transparency, one of the items was mentioned was compensation, a belief that there's excessive compensation in some nonprofits. That information is already available to the public through public disclosures that are made to the Department of Justice and to the IRS. And that's why the proponents already have that information. To the extent that they think that that's excessive compensation, they have mechanisms to address that with the organizations or with public agencies that fund those organizations or with private grantors that fund those organizations. Second, there's a concern about contracting out public functions, and we all know that nonprofits undertake a lot of activities that the public's representatives are not equipped to do, but they wish to fund. Currently, especially in healthcare, whether it's behavioral care, physical health, dental care, the way that those providers receive funds is either a direct contract with the state agency or a local government, or through reimbursement for services provided, in which case there are contracts that already exist, whether that's a contract with a CCO or a contract with a hospital or a behavioral health provider to fund those services. Those contracts are large, they are extensive, they are arguably burdensome, but they have many controls in them. They have audit provisions. If there's a concern that Cascadia Behavioral Health had a large overpayment that threatened its stability, there were already mechanisms in that contract funding those services that the state could have used all along in that process to monitor the services that were being performed and ensure that they were in compliance. There are auditing provisions in those. So those are the best mechanisms. Those are the state agencies that are close to the services. They know what they're buying. They know what they want to get. Give them the power, which they already have, hold them accountable to holding the nonprofits accountable. If there's not a contract in place, there are regulations, there are ordinances to control those services and control those funds and hold those nonprofits accountable. To put on public meetings, public records, an element in the bill that's not mentioned here so far is that all the directors and officers and employees of the nonprofits would be subject to public ethics laws. That's one thing for elected officials to be subject to. I'm not against the transparency of that, but the burden of that infrastructure, that learning, those disclosures on very small nonprofits, frankly, it makes me wonder how many directors and officers are going to step up to do an unpaid job in service of their community. Finally, I mentioned the tax-exempt organizations make many public disclosures that are already available. They are scrutinized. There is an ability for the public to comment on those. I'm concerned about chilling effects down the road. I've mentioned directors and officers that might not want to volunteer their services. I also think about nonprofits that receive public funds, but in addition receive private funds. A lot of private donations, private foundation monies, that finance those services of those nonprofits. I wonder about those funders when the nonprofit is now subject to a lot of public disclosures, public meetings, budgets, et cetera, being disclosed, being discussed. Do the private foundations want to see all of their business, all that they're funding, disclosed in a similar way? There's not a bifurcation between the public functions and the private functions. If we want to get at the public functions, we have the regulations, we have the contracts, we can focus on that already. So then I wonder, with the small nonprofits, are they going to say, you know, this infrastructure of this bill, it's onerous. Maybe we'll just pass on those public funds. Maybe we'll turn to private foundations. And then how does the public work get done if the agencies aren't doing it directly? So I'd urge you to consider keeping the focus narrow, see what tools we already have to accomplish the goods that I think the proponents are in favor of, and just follow through with those. Happy to answer questions, and thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Thanks. Appreciate your testimony. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill. Information hearing on House Bill 3321. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 39.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 39 allows the Board and Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to establish standards for suspending a private security provider's certificate or license. It also expands DPSST's authority to include the authority to suspend a private security provider's certificate or license. There is no amendments, and there is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
Thank you. Lindsay Hale, please. And you're here on the next one as well?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and I'll open a public hearing on that one as well, Senate Bill 40.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 40A is also from DPSST and does several things. First, it directs DPSST to maintain fingerprint cards for public safety officers and removes the requirement that DPSST maintain these fingerprint cards for private security providers, private investigators, or general polygraph examiners. Second, it requires all private security providers to apply for a license or certification in the same manner. It also exempts DPSST from the law requiring the use of electronic fingerprint capture technology when conducting a criminal records check. And finally, it requires any employer of a public safety officer to provide DPSST with personnel records of an employee if the records relate to the employee's qualifications, training, or certification. There is no amendments, and there is no revenue or fiscal impact.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Hale. I oversee the Professional Standards Division at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, which is more commonly known as DPSST. Senate Bill 39 comes before you on behalf of the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training and was developed in consultation with the Private Security Investigator Policy Committee as well as the Armed Subcommittee of that body. As you may be aware, DPSST is responsible for training and certifying Oregon's providers of private security services to include those who provide armed private security services. To become certified as an armed private security provider, an individual must complete the 24-hour basic firearms course, which includes a safe gun handling test and a marksmanship qualification. Armed private security certification, once issued, is good for a period of 2 years. After the first year, a certified armed private security provider is required to complete refresher training, which includes recompletion of the safe gun handling test and successful completion of the marksmanship qualification. To date, there are about 1,900 armed private security providers who are certified by DPSST. On average, 32% of those don't complete their annual training in a timely fashion. DPSST can and does initiate proceedings to revoke their armed certification of those who don't complete their training in a timely manner. However, while those proceedings, which can be very lengthy, are underway, the individual remains certified and may continue to carry or have access to firearms while providing private security services. In recognition of the potential risk in having a private security provider whose training is not current to providing armed private security services in the community, the board is requesting the authority to take immediate action in these situations by suspending the armed private security certification until the training requirements have been satisfied. So that's a very quick overview. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Why don't we go ahead and do the other and then we'll move to the work session.
Again, thank you, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lindsay Hale. I oversee the Professional Standards Division at DPSST. This legislative concept was developed as a housekeeping concept meant to clarify DPSST's fingerprinting authority. I believe it still does that. However, as Whitney mentioned, there's a few other housekeeping items that have been added along the way, including what was the Dash 1 amendments, which I'll talk about later. I think that those of you who have had to deal with fingerprint legislation over the years can appreciate how they can become very complicated and complex. So I'll try to keep this as brief as possible out of respect for your time, but while still explaining what we're trying to do here. As many of you know, as with all regulatory agencies, DPSST needs specific statutory authority to request fingerprints of constituents in order to run a state and national fingerprint check. The reason we run fingerprint checks is to ensure that those who are applying for DPSST certification and licensure meet the minimum standards established by law and rule. The first issue addressed by Senate Bill 40 deals with DPSST's fingerprint authorities for the various public and private safety disciplines we regulate. As a bit of background, currently our public safety constituents, criminal justice and fire service professionals, are issued a certification that does not expire. This means that these individuals are held to a certification standard even after leaving the field of public safety. Our private slash occupational disciplines, our private security, our private investigator, and our polygraph examiners, are issued certifications or licenses that are temporary in nature. They expire after 1 or 2 years, and the individual is then required to renew. The first issue this bill deals with has to do with the idea of retaining fingerprints. The Oregon State Police needs specific statutory authority to retain copies of fingerprints in their files. What this does is alert the regulatory body who has licensed the person whose fingerprints are being retained that there has been an arrest, presumably so the licensing body can ensure that all of the minimum standards for certification and licensure are being maintained. Current statutes, I believe the statutes came into effect around 2005, grant this retain authority for our private security, our private investigators, and our polygraph certifications and licensures. Because these certifications and licenses are temporary in nature, what happened as a result of this is that there are countless fingerprints being retained and DPSST being notified of arrests for individuals who are no longer within DPSST's jurisdiction. When this issue was recognized about a year ago, the count was about 80,000 people whose fingerprints were retained that shouldn't be. We've since worked with the state police to have the issue cleaned up, but we are requesting through Senate Bill 40 to have the retain authority removed from private security, private investigators, and polygraph disciplines. On the other hand, given the permanency of our public safety disciplines, our criminal justice, and our fire, we are asking to have that retain authority added to those disciplines that would allow DPSST to continue to be notified of arrests that occur in the state of Oregon, even if that person is no longer employed. Issue number two is truly housekeeping. It's adjusting the language dealing with the application of private security providers to be inclusive of all private security providers, which includes applications for licensure as well as certification. The third issue was noticed as the legislative concept was being prepared to address the above issues, and has to do with House Bill 3330, which passed in 2013. This bill required that electronic fingerprint capture be used exclusively to submit fingerprints to the state police. A few agencies were carved out of that requirement to include criminal justice agencies who have access to the FBI's National Crime Information Center, or NCIC. As a criminal justice agency by law, it was intended that DPSST be exempted from this requirement, an intention that was confirmed in conversations with DAS as well as the Department of Justice. However, while DPSST is a criminal justice agency by definition, DPSST does not have access to NCIC, which inadvertently excluded us from the exemption that was provided in law. So Senate Bill 40 would expressly add DPSST to the list of exemptions from the requirements of House Bill 3330. The final issue is the deals with the access to public safety officer information. ORS 181A.355 states that all public and private safety agencies must grant DPSST access to personnel records of any employee or former employee if DPSST requests that information in order to do a professional standards investigation. The definition found in statute of public and private safety agency, however, inadvertently excluded those agencies that provide correctional and parole and probation services. So those agencies employing those officers were not being afforded the same liability that agencies employing other officers were being afforded by giving us access to that information. So we again confirmed with the Department of Justice that this was inadvertent, that the intent of the legislature when creating that language was to include all employers of public safety officers. Senate Bill 40 would just simply clean this up as a housekeeping cleanup. So that was a lot of information. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Starr.
Thank you, Chair Barker. Back on Senate Bill 39, you mentioned if you have the power to suspend rather than just renew and revoke and so forth, do you currently have a list of groups that you plan on suspending?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, we require that those who are currently certified in armed private security meet the what we call maintenance training, the annual recertification requirement, retraining requirement. If they didn't, if we didn't get reported that that had happened, the suspension proceedings would presumably begin on that person until they made up their training. Is that what you're...
Follow up or clarification. I'm just wondering, if this is a problem that you've been having, which is why you want this bill.
Yes.
I'm wondering if you actually have a list of these are the specific individuals or groups mm-hmm. that we need to deal with. So do you have a list that you're kind of waiting on for this to go through in order to take disciplinary actions?
Chair Barker, Representative, my apologies, I misunderstood. It would be very easy to pull that report. And yes, there are some people that it should this become a reality, we would have to go through the rulemaking process to get all of our authorities in line. But yes, there would be a list of people who would be in violation.
Are there a lot of them?
About 32%.
Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions? Hey, thank you very much. Open a work session on Senate Bill 39.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 39 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 39 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Olson will be the carrier. Open a work session on Senate Bill 40.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 40A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 40A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none.
I'll take it.
Representative Olson will take that one as well. Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 76A.
Thank you, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 76A expands regulation of boxing and mixed martial arts to cover unarmed combat sports, which the bill defines, then makes several modifications to the statutes governing these events, and creates several exemptions for events supervised by approved amateur athletic organizations. There are no amendments, and there is a minimal fiscal and an indeterminate revenue impact.
Okay. Deputy Superintendent Davey and Lieutenant,
Bob Sharp.
Okay. Carbon copy doesn't work so well sometimes. Please, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Good afternoon. For the record, I am Terry Davey. I'm the Deputy Superintendent of the Oregon State Police. I'm here today to provide testimony on Senate Bill 76 in support of it. With me is Lieutenant Bob Charpentier, and he will be providing part of the presentation today. We do have slides, but we also know that you are very short on time, so we'll be very brief today. Great. And that way you have the information to take back with you at another time, and we are also available to meet with anybody outside of this if they need to. And please ask any questions you have, and we'll be happy to answer them. During the presentation, I will be repeating the word OSAC, and that's just an abbreviation that we commonly refer to the Oregon State Athletic Commission. So the Oregon State Athletic Commission is part of the Oregon State Police, and it used to be under our Gaming Enforcement Section, the Bureau, but we moved it to the Criminal Investigations Division when I became responsible for that back in 2014. The purpose of the Oregon State Athletic Commission is to protect the health and safety and the best interests of the competitors and participants associated with the events regulated by the Oregon State Athletic Commission. Back in 1988, the legislature created the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission, and the focus for that was on regulatory functions related to wrestling and professional boxing here in Oregon. In 1999, the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling Commission became part of the Oregon State Police, and we assumed the regulatory functions of that commission. As the years progressed in 2004, the sport of mixed martial arts became very popular in Oregon, but there was no regulatory authority over the sports, and a lot of people were getting injured and hurt. So in 2007, the Oregon State Police developed a response to that, and that's where Senate Bill 492 was introduced and eventually passed. The bill did a few things back then, 10 years ago, and it expanded the roles of the commission and the responsibilities related to the sport of mixed martial arts. It also limited the scope of authority for the commission regarding wrestling, and it only focused it then on entertainment wrestling was the main focus of the commission. The bill also changed the name from the Oregon Boxing and Wrestling to the Oregon State Athletic Commission because now we were regulating mixed martial arts. And it also set up a medical advisory committee, which allowed us to have some physicians that act as an oversight to give us the medical field's point of view on the sports that we're regulating and how to ensure the safety and the security of the competitors. And at that time, back in 2007, there was a package presented forward for additional FTEs. Unfortunately, it wasn't approved, but we were given authority to use the general funding for the commission, and we have been doing that since. So currently, the Athletic Commission, we do have a commission board which has five volunteer members on it, and they provide the oversight and the expertise. We also have the Medical Advisory Committee, which is five physicians throughout Oregon that we have recruited and brought on board to help us. And then we do have staff that we have to oversee the commission from the Oregon State Police point of view. We have an event administrator, which is our full-time FTE position. We have a governmental auditor, a compliance specialist, and then an office specialist that assist us with the day-to-day operations. Currently, we are vacant on two of those positions, so we're hoping that July 1 we'll be able to bring on board the other two members that will help us with the commission. So as far as the commission itself, right now we regulate the sports of professional boxing, professional kickboxing, and amateur in those two sports also, mixed martial arts, both professional and amateur, and then also the entertainment wrestling. We do research on the illegal smokers that do occur in Oregon and try to do what we can to ensure that illegal events are not held. So I'm going to move to Sergeant Charpentier at this moment to talk about some of the challenges we have with Senate Bill 76, ORS 463, and that's why we're here today for Senate Bill 76.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Bob Charpentier. I'm a lieutenant with the State Police. And to go in the garage to some of these challenges, Chapter 463 contradicts itself in several places, and our goal really with Senate Bill 76 is to clear up those contradictions and to streamline and clarify what our role is, not only for us, but for our constituents, for the promoters, and for the competitors that we deal with on a daily basis. there. During this review, we realized one of the big contradictions is who is responsible for the payment of officials. So currently that's us, based off that review that we did, and our goal with this Senate Bill 76 is to change that back to the promoters where it was back in 2014. So it's, we're going to realign the fees. And then we really want to align also what we're responsible for in regards to regulation. Muay Thai is also becoming very popular, and our goal is to take on that responsibility as well. So if you look at the slide, some of the highlights that Senate Bill 76 is going to do is it does clarify who is responsible for the payment of officials. It clarifies what OSAC is responsible for today and what OSAC is going to be responsible for in the future. So this change with Senate Bill 76 will help us for years down the road, so we don't have to come back and change it. It allows us and gives us a clear definition of what unarmed combat sport is in Oregon. It also allows us the opportunity to defer regulation to an amateur athletic organization, and I'll go over that what that is here in just a second. You can see up on the board that the definition of unarmed combat sports is there. I won't bore you, and I'll save time by not reading it. But this definition really clarifies what OSAC's responsibility is in Oregon. Again, not only for today, but also for the future. It tells us what we can regulate and what we're not responsible to regulate. Again, up here on the board, you'll see another definition of an amateur athletic organization. And to give you an example, one of the contradictions is what is OSAC's role with amateur boxing and professional boxing? Well, we learned that we do have some sort of responsibility with amateur boxing. In amateur boxing in Oregon, we're talking about 8-year-olds that are boxing in Oregon, and that's something that we don't feel is our responsibility with the state police. And the deputy and I went to an event in Beaverton and watched these young kids box. And really that amateur athletic organization is there to foster that skill and really build these kids up or these young adults up mm-hmm. in the sport. Giving an example, USA Boxing has been around since 1888, and it's the governing body for amateur boxing. And our goal with this, or one of the goals with Senate Bill 76, is to really allow USA Boxing to continue to do what they've been doing since 1888. So they've been doing it for a long time. They do a very good job. They're very safe. And we want them to be able to keep doing that. We don't want that responsibility. They've done an amazing job. Let's keep it that way. There's also amateur athletic organizations for other unarmed combat sports. You know, there's WTBA for, you know, which is the World Thai Boxing Association. There's many more. And we want to allow them to continue to support that amateur unarmed combat sport. Some of the other highlights, like we discussed, it realigns the officials' compensation. It also allows all our officials to be licensed. Currently, the superintendent chooses some of our officials, and we want the superintendent of the state police to be able to focus on public safety responsibilities, not OSAC regulatory responsibilities. So some of those changes include the superintendent being able to delegate to an authorized representative to make those day-to-day decisions. You'll see up here on the board that Senate Bill 76 also places a cap on gross receipts. We believe that larger promotions avoid Oregon due to the high gross receipts tax, and our goal is we want to attract these larger promotions to, you know, really support small business in Oregon, and having a large organization like the Ultimate Fighting Championship come to Oregon, it's going to have an economic ripple throughout the state with, you know, hotels, you know, training facilities, grocery stores, transit. You know, it attracts a large crowd. So that cap really allows and makes Oregon more palatable to these larger organizations. The second one you can see supports small business and allows promoters more time to pay their tax. This next slide, if you look at the very bottom right, that's the kind of the key number for us. OSAC currently averages a net loss of $3,420 per event due to statutory contradictions today. Our goal is to clean that up and have a smaller economic footprint in that area. So that's really the key number. And again, we're more than happy later on to clarify any of that or answer more questions about that. Moving on. Again, on this slide, we're going to look at that bottom number. We currently project a net loss of $1,051,884 general fund dollars for this biennium for OSAC. And again, Senate Bill 76 will really help us reduce that. And really to close, OSAC is responsible for the health and safety of our competitors, and we're here to support small business. Senate Bill 76 is a foundational change for us that will realign and clean up language and statute and streamline things. Then we'll be able to go through the administrative rule and match up administrative rule with statute and provide a solid regulatory job for the state of Oregon. It supports small business. It helps protect the health and safety of competitors of unarmed combat sports that we currently regulate and that will regulate in the future or could potentially regulate in the future. If you look, this is our last slide, is a picture of what it, the number of officials, 25 in that picture, that it took to regulate the UFC event that we had in 2016. So it requires a lot of officials, and it's a big commitment for folks, and our goal is just to make the sport safer in Oregon.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions for the panel?
Well, I do, Mr. Chair. So, Lieutenant, the old guy that's way in the back is in the middle.
We could block him out.
Okay.
Hey, thank you very much. Close the public hearing. Open a work session on Senate Bill 76A.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 76A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 76A to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
What? Is that why I'm smiling? Yes. Sure.
Representative Post will be the carrier. Okay, committee, we'll stand adjourned, get back to the floor.
All right. Thank you. All right.
Okay, committee, we'll stand adjourned, get back to the floor.